I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with Indiana writer Janet Cheatham Bell, the author and editor of more than a dozen books. Most recently, Not All Poor People Are Black and Other Things We Need to Think More About. We're going to discuss questions of race, justice, faith, and power. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz, toll-free, at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can tumble upon us on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with Indiana author Janet Cheatham Bell, who is most recently the author of Not All Poor People Are Black and Other Things We Need to Think More About. She's got a long history as an author and editor, and we're going to talk about that. If you would like to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Janet, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. So let's start by talking a little bit about the genesis of this most recent book. It's a collection of essays. Some of them are biographical. Some of them are explorations of it's almost like a spiritual autobiography in parts, and some of them are social commentary. You talk about how you got the idea for the book and really what prompted you to write it.
Well, actually, I write all the time. Mm-hmm. And some of these were blog entries about things that annoyed me at the time, and I updated them or reshaped them for the collection of essays. And actually, one of the essays is an excerpt from a memoir that I'm in the progress of writing. But I understand the world I live in by writing about it. And I understand issues that plague me by writing about them. And I was a little hesitant to put these together in a book and publish it because I wasn't sure if anybody else would be interested in what I had to say about what was going on in my head. But the reception has been good, so I'm happy about that. But my primary purpose for writing this book is to alert people to the fact that we are more powerful than we think we are, not only individually, but when we come together and organize in a group. We have power that we don't use. And I really want people to think about that and hopefully to question some of the things that they take for granted.
One of the things I noted in reading your book, in addition to that sense of it, attempting to alert people to sources of empowerment that they might not be aware of, and this sort of marched almost in lockstep with that theme, was this idea that many of the limitations that we think define our lives are ones that we in fact impose upon ourselves.
Absolutely. Because issues get framed in a certain way, and that framing keeps being repeated and repeated, and we start to accept that as the truth. When in fact, if we ever stop to question it or to test it, we'd find that it's not the truth. I've found that in my own life, and that's why I write about how I discovered my own power, is because I was placing limits on myself without knowing it, without being conscious of it. And then, I've always questioned things. My mother said I asked more questions than her other three children put together. So that's my nature. But I started acting on some of my questions and testing the accuracy of the things that I believed and found that they weren't true.
So let's talk a little bit about the journey that led you to writing this book. You are, you know, your roots in Indiana are pretty deep, right?
Yes, I was born and raised in Indianapolis.
What part of the city?
Southside.
Southside?
Went to Manual High School.
Okay. And, you know, that without, it, you're comfortable talking about your age. I mean, this was...
I was in the second group of students to integrate the schools in Indianapolis. When I started school, in elementary school, the schools were segregated by law here. And so I went to an all-black elementary school. Everybody there was black, from the principal to the janitor and all the students. The only exception was there were two Native American students in our school. They weren't black, but I guess they had too much color to go to the white school, so they got to go to school with us.
And that's obviously one of the mistaken perceptions we have both about this state's history and about U.S. history in general, that segregation was a Southern phenomenon and not a national one.
Absolutely. And I experienced all of it right here in Indianapolis. When I was growing up, blacks did not have office jobs in downtown Indianapolis. If there was a black person working in an office, it was his own business. The only people that I knew of who had offices were the doctors that we went to see. I remember when I read comic strips and saw all those stories about Dad going to the office, I couldn't imagine what that was.
It was like another planet.
Right, exactly. I mean, my father worked as a butcher for a meatpacking plant. My friends' fathers worked in the steel manufacturing places at the foundry, they called it. So I didn't know anybody. The only person I knew who had a job with an office was the principal of our school.
What was it like? I mean, you said you were part of that second group that integrated Indianapolis.
The second year.
Second year. What was it like being part of that integration process?
Well, looking back on it, I can see that the students themselves didn't pay much attention to us one way or the other. But the administrators and teachers were like acutely aware of us and had certain assumptions about us that we weren't smart and that we were different, that we weren't just another student. We were something different, alien. Mm-hmm. And there were all kinds of things we weren't allowed to do. If you can believe it, when I was in high school at Manual back in the 50s, the black guys weren't even allowed to play basketball on the varsity team. I mean, that shows you how far away we are now from there. Because one thing they now welcome black men to do is play sports, but they didn't even let them play varsity basketball. And I think after a year or two, they did let them play. But the first couple of years, it's like they didn't know what to do with them. I mean, obviously they could play basketball because they played on the what they call the JV team or whatever. Mm-hmm. But putting them on the varsity team, I don't know. Will people accept that?
Well, what I find intriguing about that is, you know, that's the same time when Crispus Attucks had two of arguably the finest high school basketball teams, and not just in Indiana, but anywhere ever.
Exactly. And I cheered for the Attucks team, even though I was a student at Manual. And some of my, I've been in touch with some of my fellow students from Manual in recent years after I wrote my memoir. And it's hard for them to understand why I don't feel about Manual the same way they do. They can't quite grasp it.
Well, how do you feel about Manual?
I don't feel much of anything. It was an experience that I had. I learned some things from it. It was my first experience being with white people on a daily basis. Before that, my life was entirely black. Even though I lived in a neighborhood with whites, we didn't socialize together. I mean, I saw them, but we didn't really do anything with each other. And so my life was entirely black. So going to Manual was my first regular contact with white people. So I saw them as pretty alien, too, to be quite honest with you. And because I had brought up being taught that they didn't like us, didn't want us anywhere near them, and they felt superior to us. And that was all I knew about them. So I hated them.
We are talking with the Indiana author Janet Cheatham Bell, who is the author of Not All Poor People Are Black and Other Things We Need to Think More About. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So you're from Indianapolis here on the South Side. And had obviously that experience of being really the first wave of integration in the city and in some ways in the state. From there, though, it was kind of an unlikely path. There was an interest obviously in literature from some of your earliest days. I mean, you'd studied I'm anticipating your story when I should just let you tell it. So why don't you tell us where you went to for Manual?
Well, I always loved books, and reading was my passion. And fortunately, I had several jobs in libraries, which helped to encourage that passion for reading. And one story I have to tell about Manual is that there was a counselor at Manual who pulled me out of class one day to ask me why I wasn't in the college prep program, because he could see that my grades were really good, and I didn't even know what the college prep program was. Neither one of my parents went to college. No, my counselor was telling me to take home ec so I could be a good domestic. So when he pulled me out to ask me why I wasn't in college prep, I didn't know what he was talking about. But he's the one who encouraged me to take the SAT, and I got a scholarship to Indiana University.
And you attended IU then?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And what was that experience? Because you're moving into southern Indiana at that point.
Well, we were always nervous driving through Martinsville. But I had a great time at Indiana University. Bloomington was segregated, but we had like a little small mini black college inside of Indiana University. And we had a great social life, and we had a lot of fun. I had so much fun that I had to come home for a while.
Anything you care to share there? It sounds like there's more of a story than we're hearing.
I was partying more than I was going to class and studying, so I had to drop out and regroup and go back.
Well, some things do not change. Students still do that. So at what point, and we're going to skip ahead because part of, I think, the really fascinating part of your book is when you say we really need to expand the definition of what an entrepreneur is. And you apply that in your life with your passion, which really was for the written word. But there were a lot of steps. I mean, you did not publish your first book until the mid-1980s, right?
Right.
So how did you get, you know, what steps led you up to that point?
Well, I got a job working as an editor in a textbook company on literature anthologies in Boston, and learned the inside of publishing. And I had been an English major in college, and I had worked as a education consultant for the Indiana Department of Education. And that's why they wanted me to work on textbooks. And that led me into publishing my own books. And so I left, moved to Chicago, which is a great city for entrepreneurs, especially black entrepreneurs. And that's where I got started. And it was a very encouraging atmosphere and all kinds of professional organizations to support me.
And that's a great place for us to take just a short break here. We are talking with Indiana author Janet Cheatham Bell. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with Indiana author Janet Cheatham Bell. She is the author of, among other works, Not All Poor People Are Black, and Other Things We Need to Think More About, and Famous Black Quotations and Some Not So Famous. Well, we were talking just before we went to the break about how you'd gotten to know the publishing business, and you'd relocated to Chicago with your son at that point. What prompted you to think, well, I ought to get into the publishing business myself? You know, I ought to do it. You set up your own publishing company, and that was really how you started your own book, right?
Correct. Because I knew a lot about the book publishing industry, I knew that they wouldn't be interested in a collection of black quotations. I had tried to get an agent, and I couldn't even get an agent. So I knew that, okay, if I go directly to a publisher with this idea, it's not going to work. So I said, okay, I know how books are published, so I'll do it myself. So I did. And the first two collections that I published were small pocket-sized books, but they sold like hotcakes. And the 8 years that I was publishing those two little books, I sold over 90,000 copies. And at that point, I was able to get a publisher. And I licensed the publishing rights to Warner Books, because publishing is not just the glamorous part. Mm-hmm. It also requires collecting money from your people that you're selling books to.
Yeah, it's a lot like running a business.
Yes. And so I was happy to let that part go so that I could spend more time making books rather than publishing them.
I'm always interested when you do a book like that. People don't realize that you also have to go out and push it.
Yes.
And almost every author has some story about, a humbling experience when the first, because you think when you write this first book that, it's magically going to appear in the hands of readers and they're going to love it and all of that. They're going to care as much about it as I do. And you don't realize how much of this breaks down to things like doing signings and readings and all of that. I remember when my first book came out, being at a mall on the west side of the state, and the bookstore had set the table where I was supposed to do the signing out in front, out in the mall hallway, as it were, passageway. And I spent the better part of 3 hours informing people where the restrooms were or where the cooking section might be or things like that. So if you would, every time I have a writer on this show, I ask a question. What was the most absurd or humbling experience you had with getting that first book off the ground?
Well, I guess time heals all wounds, because I only have fond memories. What I remember is that My first printing, this was before the days of the internet, my first printing was for 5,000 books.
And which is a big order.
It's huge. And only ignorance would have allowed me to order 5,000 books. But I was trying to keep the unit price down. Mm-hmm. And but I also bought ads in national publications and went to Book Expo and promoted it there. So about 3 or 4 months later, a textbook publisher in Chicago, whom the president of the company I knew because I worked with him at where I worked before, he ordered 2,000 copies to give away and at a conference. And I didn't have enough books to fill his order. Yeah, that my book sold like hotcakes.
Oh, wow.
Literally.
Well, for a first book and for, you know, relatively unknown author and all of that.
Oh, totally unknown.
That is phenomenal. We are talking with Indiana author Janet Cheatham Bell here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Pete, welcome to the program.
Wanted to make a few comments. I went to Shortridge High School at the same time as your guest,
mm-hmm.
and it was highly integrated, and we, all of our teams had black people. In fact, some of my best friends were black. I was on the wrestling team, and actually Frank Anderson became Marion County Sheriff. And we had a lot of smart black people, too. It's too bad your guest didn't go to Shortridge. I had a great experience there. I had lots of black friends. I don't think things were probably equal, as we understand now. But from my standpoint, I think the people that black people went to Shortridge High School had a very positive experience.
What year did you graduate from high school, Pete?
I was there 1954 to 1958.
Okay. Well,
so I'm an old person too. I don't think of myself that way, but anyway, it was a positive experience, and I think your guest would have enjoyed that.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Pete, and the comment.
My pleasure.
Thank you. So.
Well, Pete's a little younger than I am.
He is? Okay.
I graduated in 1954.
Okay, so you were, actually, you graduated then the year that Brown versus the Board of Education.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so he's about 4 years younger and therefore
right.
a little bit further ahead on the district.
And Shortridge,
because
of where Shortridge was located, they undoubtedly had more black students than we did at Manual. There weren't that many black people on the South Side. So I would imagine they had a higher percentage of blacks. There were only about 50 of us in a school of 1,700 at Manual when I was there.
I'm going to ask what is a simple question but not an easy one. Why is it, do you think, that as a culture race continues to bedevil us?
Because we've never faced it. We've talked about race. I'm 77 years mm-hmm. old. We'll soon be 78. Mm-hmm. In my lifetime of those 78 years, there has been more public discussion of race in the United States since Barack Obama was elected president, which was in 2008, so mm-hmm. the last 7 years, than there had been in the previous 70 years of my life altogether.
Even during the Civil Rights era?
During the Civil Rights era, there was activism around it,
yeah.
but we didn't talk about race and the nuances of race and the whole thing now that they're talking about the privileges of white people.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have those kinds of discussions then. And the fact that these black men who are being killed by the police, that's been going on forever. That's mm-hmm. not new. But now the outrage extends beyond the black community. That's a first. Because we have been dealing with that forever. And so I'm encouraged by the fact that we are discussing race openly, and maybe the internet and social media have a lot to do with that too.
How much of a watershed was Barack Obama's election?
It was a watershed in a way that I totally wasn't expecting. First of all, I really did not anticipate, I don't know why, the backlash, I guess you have to call it, mm-hmm. of the overt disrespect of the office of the presidency by elected officials to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't expecting that. I thought that people, no matter how much they may have disliked him, that they would still respect the office of the presidency. But that's obviously not the case.
Yeah, I think just not long before we went on the air, on Fresh Air, David Axelrod was the guest, and he said, yeah, is race the predominant factor in the opposition to Barack Obama's presidency? Maybe not, but it's definitely a factor, and he cited exactly the same sort of disrespect, that there'd never been a president who would have a member of Congress shout in the middle of a speech, "You lie," at a state function. But your contention is that things seem to be getting better as a result.
Yeah, I think the watershed with all of the treatment of Obama and the lack of respect has appalled some people that hadn't paid much attention to racism before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think social media has a lot to do with it as well. But for the first time, people are actually having open discussions about race. And that hasn't happened. And that's one of the reasons why it continues to bedevil us, is because we've refused to face it. Mm-hmm. We've acted like, you know, don't talk about that. That was a long time ago. But even though we're willing to accept the legacy of slavery, great fortunes were built in this country mm-hmm. on the slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
And Brown University and Yale University have acknowledged their culpability in that. And maybe some other universities have, too. But what we call old money in this country comes from the slave trade. And so we are willing to accept them passing that money on generation after generation. But we don't want to hear from black people about how the legacy of slavery impacted us and the way we've been treated since then. We don't want to talk about that, but we accept the other legacies of slavery, the economic legacies.
When you talk about how, obviously, I'm part of that larger defining culture. I'm a Caucasian, a European Caucasian. When you talk about what that legacy has meant to black people, and I think one of the worst things we can do is ask anybody to deny his or her own individuality and presume to speak for an entire demographic group. So all I'm going to ask here is that you talk about how that legacy has shaped you and your life.
Well, as I said previously, I grew up thinking the white people hated us, loathed us, didn't want us anywhere close to them. That's why we couldn't work with them. We couldn't go to school with them, couldn't live in the same neighborhoods. So, of course, defensively, we hated them back.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up thinking that I really thought whites were omnipotent. I thought they could do anything they wanted. I thought they all had money, that, you know, there were no limits on them. I mean, after all, they didn't have to deal with racism. Now that I'm older and wiser, what I see is that whites are pretty much just like us. I mean, even lacking the impediment of racism, most white people are not doing any better than we are. There is that, you know, small group at the top that is doing much better than everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But most whites, and I know a lot of white people, I have friends, some of my best friends are white. Or as my son puts it, mm-hmm. some of my best whites are friends. I think I like that better. Anyway, and I know that they haven't noticed that they are not being discriminated against. I mean, you don't notice something that's not there. Mm-hmm. So they have the same personal issues in their lives that we have in ours, you know, trying to pay the mortgage, trying to, you know, get enough food, dealing with their personal demons, whatever they may be. And I have discovered that the childhoods of most white people that I know were not that much different than mine, except that they didn't have to deal with racism.
Do you think, I mean, at least in a, at a scientific level, I mean, race is a...
does not exist.
Yeah, I mean, it's a... the same thing that determines the color of my eyes determines the color, a pigment, basically. And we don't discriminate, by and large, you know, between blue-eyed and brown-eyed people. I guess how much of this, because it, race is almost exclusively a social construct.
Absolutely.
Comes down, you know, there's almost like a, it's like it's a cruel joke that we've been, you know, humanity has been ripping itself apart for centuries now.
Mm-hmm.
Over how do we get past that? You know, you're not just, you're not the only voice in your family dealing with these issues.
No.
Your son, obviously, is carved out. And this is your chance to brag on your child for a little bit if you'd like to. Is also carved out a voice in this area as well.
Right. He said to me some time ago, he said, I'm just continuing the family business, Ma. because my father was, my parents were both race people and working to improve conditions for black people. And he does what they call sociopolitical comedy and is racial justice ambassador for the ACLU.
And was the host of Totally Biased on
yes, on
FX.
Television.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he has a show called The W. Kamau Bell Curve, where he talks about race and all its permutations in our society, because, you know, blacks are not the only ones who get discriminated against.
How did you feel about him entering into what you call the family business?
Well, actually, when he first started, I said to him, I said, you don't have to do this to please me, because I thought he was doing it because he thought I would like it. And he looked at me like I had lost my mind. He said, I'm not doing this to please you, because, you know, as a young black man, he has encountered plenty of discrimination on his own. And is very much aware of himself out in public as a big black male.
Yeah, he's a 6'4" black male.
Yes.
So, tricky question, because he's not here to speak for himself. So I'm going to ask his mother to speak for him. But in what ways has his experience regarding race been different than yours? And are his perceptions different? In any way.
His perceptions are different because he grew up going to school from first grade on with whites, and he knew early on that all whites were not smarter than he was. And so he didn't have that limitation of thinking that they were superior. But as an adult, the fact that he's a black male and a big black male means that he is never invisible, ever. Sometimes people don't notice me, but people always notice him.
We are talking with Indiana author Janet Cheatham Bell. She is the author of Not All Poor People Are Black and Other Things We Need to Think More About, and also Famous Black Quotations and Some Not So Famous. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Again, we are talking with Indiana author Janet Cheatham Bell. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking with Indiana author Janet Cheatham Bell. She is the author of Not All Poor People Are Black and Other Things We Need to Think More About, and also, among many other books, Famous Black Quotations and Some Not So Famous. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you. And I want to, I'm calling to give Ms. Bell a special, special commendation and hats off. I now know that I'm probably close to 20 years younger than you, Ms. Bell. I class of 68 at Chittard High School, and I too grew up as the earlier caller Pete did in the area where Shortridge. I always wanted to go to Shortridge, and my parents were very involved with the civil rights movement. And so I grew up in a situation where I thought, gosh, just as soon as there was a decision that we'd all get along, that's what would happen. But to my utter surprise in education, when I went off to school at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and took a black, I think it was a black history course, and that was new. And a couple of us from that class reached out to the very few African-American students who were there. In our case, it was, I think, primarily women. And thinking that and assuming that as we reached out to say hi and introduce that, our African-American counterparts would be, you know, very happy to know there were some white people who were nice and all this. The surprise was learning firsthand, as I can see her standing in her dorm door. She opened it to me, and she burst into tears and said, "I don't trust any white people." And she described the despicable way that her she had been treated on the hall in the dorm, so hateful. And this was in fall of 68, and I went on, had the absolute privilege of attending Father Boniface Hardin's first class. I think it was the summer of 70 71. But again, what I learned over time, and as recently as coming back to Indiana, it's now been 18 years ago, the gap of reality between us well-intentioned white people living on the north side, and I thought this was, that being involved with the civil rights thing was normal, but the gap between that and what most African Americans have experienced from their perspective, and the very hateful behavior. And my daughter, who's now 26, but she thought I was making it up until she witnessed how differently we white people were treated compared to right there an African American grandmother. This was in 2001. As well as our neighbor, who was African American, and we just had firsthand real life experiences of how different it is, and the gap between most of us white people, who are not absolutely poor but are in comfortable circumstances, from both African Americans and then, in addition, those who are just in dire poverty. And with regard to all black people are not poor, I had the privilege of mom and dad, as part of the Northside Civil Rights Group, I can't believe I know, Dr. He started the first bank here in Indianapolis, Lloyd, Dr. Lloyd, and there were many African Americans with masters and PhDs here on the north side, but Riviera Club was closed to them. That just got mm-hmm. opened, I think, in the last 20 years or something. So back to, I want to commend you both for figuring out that indeed you are intelligent and capable, and congratulations on self-publishing and your own publishing company and the success of your books. But in addition to that, I think I may hear some still bruising and hurt from what you went through. And again, you were coming 20 years before I went through it. And number two, but I don't hear any hatred. And
let me, Margaret, if it's okay, let me let that, there's a fair bit here. Let me let Janet respond to that. Thank you very much for the call and for sharing your story. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for the guest.
Certainly.
Welcoming.
Thank you. Okay, Janet, please.
Yes, you never forget the pain of some of the things that happen, especially things that happen to you when you're in your early formative years. But no, hatred is like drinking poison and hoping somebody else dies. And I don't do that. Not anymore.
Why is it you think that that so many white people are reluctant or, reluctant's probably too soft a word, to acknowledge racism as a presence in our culture?
I think it's shame and guilt. Mm-hmm. It's shame and guilt because they don't want to be identified with the whites who have been doing these cruel things. There was just a new report released recently about the fact that they have documentation of nearly 4,000 lynchings of black people since the Civil War ended. And things were done to black people that we're now being appalled at that are being done by ISIS. And so a few people have been on social media posting, the kind of terrorism that we are, quote, fighting around the world. It was happening in this country to black people for years. So, but if we, and some people have succumbed to hatred, and I did too for a long time. But what I understood is that hatred is self-debilitating. It doesn't hurt anybody except you. Mm-hmm. And I don't care to inflict pain on myself. So I've let that go and use that energy in much more constructive ways.
Well, in terms of, this is a tricky question. I want to think how I want to frame it. How much of this is also about the semantics? At a newspaper I worked at years ago, they mandated that all employees had to go through what they called diversity training. You're rolling your eyes. That doesn't play well on the radio. That's why I'm illustrating it. And my argument at the time was, I don't disagree with the goals, but, why are we calling this diversity training? Because that basically just gives bigots a club to beat us with here, when it should be called decency training or just basic manners.
Or inclusiveness.
Yeah.
I mean, diverse from what?
Mm-hmm.
See, that automatically puts a negative spin on it.
Well, yeah, it establishes white culture then
as
the
norm. Thank
you.
I hate that word, diversity. And the way it's being used is, I don't like that word. I like inclusive better. And I have an essay in my book called The Big White Lie, mm-hmm. that things get framed in a certain way, and like I said, keep being repeated, and people come to accept that as the truth. But this is not a white country. It never has been. And yet, people like Patrick Buchanan wrote a book called State of Emergency, The Invasion of America by third world people. By that, he means anybody who's not European.
Yeah, one of my favorite, when I was in Arizona a couple of years ago, I saw a T-shirt in southern Arizona that had Native Americans, and the words below it says, "We agree that we need to get a handle on illegal immigration."
Exactly.
Which I thought illustrated the point. So how do we begin framing these questions so that we do have a more honest and more productive conversation about race?
Well, I think we've started just the fact that we're not having public discussions about racism. That's the start, because we're acknowledging its existence. So, and you can't fix something that you don't see. And at least now we're saying we see it. But I think that it won't ever change until about my granddaughter's generation, I think, will see a significant change. My son's generation is significantly different than mine. Mm-hmm. And I think by my granddaughter's generation, things will be, because for one thing, by the time my granddaughter is an adult, there will no longer be a predominant, quote, race in this country.
Mm-hmm.
There will be multiple different looking people from all over the world, as there has always been. But whites will not be in the dominant power position and the dominant culture norm setting position. Mm-hmm. So it's going to change. It's changing now. That's why there's so much vitriol being spewed, because mm-hmm. people can see the change coming.
And it scares them.
It scares them.
How do you feel about, Black History Month? I mean, do you see it as a celebration, or do you see it as, the cliche often is, we're going to celebrate Black History Month. It's the shortest month of the year. it's a way to get past it. It's almost like it's being shoved into its own confined area when it should be just part of the human experience.
It should be a part of American history.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't.
Yeah.
It's not an accurate history of this country. It's not taught in our educational institutions, period.
Mm-hmm.
So if the only way we can get attention to the history of African American people is to set aside a month for it, then so be it.
Mm-hmm.
And also now I think there's a Hispanic History Month too.
Mm-hmm.
And probably before too long there'll be an Asian History Month as well. I really would prefer that we didn't have to divide things up like that. But until we change things at the core,
mm-hmm.
it will be that way. And I think some universities are changing their core curriculums to be more inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll take a long time before it trickles down to the public school arena, if there's still a public school arena left.
Mm-hmm. And that will be one of the subjects, I guess, of Thursday's show when we've got Glenda Ritz on the air. We are talking with author Janet Cheatham Bell here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Renee, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. It's an honor to be a guest today, or to talk to your guest, rather, and for you to have taken my call. Janet, I just wanted to address the comment that you just made when you were asked why you think that white people are reluctant to admit to the fact that racism still exists. And you said it is guilt and shame. And I personally, I'm 36 years old. I'm college educated. I consider myself one of the most loving. I love people. I love diversity. I love people for their differences. But I certainly don't feel any guilt or shame at all when I think, does racism still exist? Well, we acknowledge, yes, in some individuals from certain demographics or certain age groups, I think especially. And I work in healthcare, and I see that a lot with older demographics, people who are Southern. Hate to say it, but that's where I kind of sense some of that. but personally, to go back to that, I don't feel any guilt or shame. When I think of racism in our culture, I think, what more can we do? And maybe I could pose that question to you, Janet, because I feel like the civil rights movement has come and gone. I teach my children. I don't want my children to see color, okay? Their generation should not see color. We spend a lot of time with different people in the community, and but what more as a white individual, I don't have any guilt or shame. I don't identify with what my ancestors did. That was a long, long time ago. This is a new generation, you know, henceforth.
Okay. If I could, Renee, we're getting a little tight on time, and I want to give Janet a chance to respond.
Can I give one more suggestion, though, please?
Sure.
I think the media, Janet, I think that the media and what we see on television has a lot to do with people's racial point of view, because a lot of these talk shows that I think are just trash, Steve Wilkos, Maury Povich, you know, those shows, they really make African Americans out to look, I think, very bad. And I think that's one thing that could change. Okay. People need to no more of portraying these people all day on television
okay.
with their problems.
Renee, we really
anyway,
are getting...
I'll take the answer off the air. Thank
all right.
You so
Thank
much
you
for
very
taking
much.
My call. Have
Certainly.
A blessed day.
Thank you. Janet.
Well, first of all, let me apologize for putting you into a group, into a general group. I was speaking of those whites who refuse to acknowledge racism and don't want blacks talking about racism. I wasn't obviously talking about you. And I certainly do know that not all whites feel that way. Like I say, some of my best friends are white. But what I say to people who ask me, what can they do? There are two things, and you've obviously already done them, but that is, whenever they're in a group of all whites and they hear racist comments, they can speak out rather than just cringing. And the second thing they can do is make a friend with somebody who doesn't share your melanin.
Okay. We've gotten also, and I'm real quickly, an email from Judith who says, you know, her upbringing was very similar to yours, with the exception that she was white, but she, you know, because she was working class and all of that, her father didn't go up. She wonders if perhaps we emphasize the differences too much and not the commonness of our experience, the commonality. Fair point? Real quickly, maybe one or two words?
It's just that blacks have been treated so differently because of our skin color that we make that emphasis.
Thank you very much, Janet Cheatham Bell. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.